starting part one, Sabrina George interviewing Ivor Dambina, who is a promoter. Well, let me ask you what you call yourself.
Well, the reality is I do two things. I run a comedy club in London, and have run comedy clubs in London and put on comedy gigs for getting on 25 years now. So I think I'm probably best known as someone who puts on comedy. But for most of that time, I've also performed comedy on my own, not just in the role of compere at my own clubs. But I had a short career on the circuit, and then went off and wrote and performed solo comedy shows, which I still now do.
So let's go back to the point I always like starting with people in interviews, is what was your first action to become a comic?
Well, I basically, the same as anybody else, I saw some other comedians and thought I could do that. And I very quickly discovered that if I could, it was going to take a long time. I was there and pretty near the beginning of the comedy boom in this country. I went to one of the early first shows at the Comedy Store in around 1980. It had only been going about a year, and thought, this is amazing, very exciting, very energised, very amateur in the best sense of the word, of people just doing it for its own sake. And I suppose that was my first connection, was actually seeing others do it. My first actual standing at a microphone and entertaining the audience was probably to do with the fact that I opened my own club, and in those days the person who ran the club, they were the compere, and you just stood up and you just introduced the act. You weren't expected to be funny, and indeed I wasn't. But I kind of got, during that period, I got a bit stage struck. I quite enjoyed standing up under the spotlight and holding a microphone.
So what comedy were you seeing before you went to the comedy club? Were you going to see any of the old comics? Or?
Oh, what, you mean pre-comedy
stuff? Yeah.
Not really. I don't think I ever went to I hardly ever went to a comedy show. I remember once when I was a student, that would have been 10 years before, I went to see Tommy Cooper at some kind of nightclub. That's the only one I can immediately think of. Comedy, just going to live comedy, which is now part of the cultural landscape, just wasn't like that when I was younger. You didn't go and see comedians in the way people go and see comedians they do now. It's like they might go to a film, they might go to a theatre, they might go to see a dance show, or they might go to comedy. Comedy is now, as I say, it's a fixture, which it wasn't then. And that's, I guess, what made it kind of so exciting. But what gave it an additional layer of excitement, these were in small venues and you were close up and you could see the whites of the comedian's eyes. So you were really, you were part of the process. The audience was very, very important to this.
So why did you go that night?
Around that time, I was embarked upon a failed career as a playwright. But I got a play on, actually, which was terrible. Not terrible that I got it on, the play was terrible. But amongst the cast was a man called Jim Barclay, who was a struggling fringe actor. Just talking to him over a cup of tea in between rehearsals, he told me about this thing called the Comedy Store that he was having a go at doing. He was having a go at himself. And he did. It sounds great. He said, you should come down one night. It's midnight on a Saturday night, and we'll get up, we'll do some stuff. I'd vaguely heard about it elsewhere, but here was someone who actually was doing it. So I kind of went down there to see Jim. But the whole... I was quickly... I was pleased to go and see him, but really the whole atmosphere, the whole... excitement of it all just completely seduced me immediately, and I just immediately knew I wanted to be involved. I wasn't sure how. And what I decided to do was basically steal the idea of the Comedy Store and put on a local version of it in Tufnell Park, which I did quite successfully. And in those days, you'd open a club up and shows a few weeks later because the landlord would kick you out, or because there was no audience, or for a whole host of reasons. But what I discovered quite early on, I did have a talent for doing this. I understood the basic things you needed to do to put on a comedy club. And I don't mind anyone knowing it. It's very, very easy and doesn't require a great deal of work, provided you do that small amount of work to the best of your ability and you bear certain basic rules in mind. You need good sound, you need good lights, and you need the audience facing the stage. Those are the only three things.
You don't even need a stage.
You don't even need a stage. You can do it on the floor. And obviously it helps if you can have it in a room that has a convivial atmosphere, is in an area where there's a demographic of people who are likely to want to enjoy that kind of entertainment, which at that time in Tufnell Park they certainly did. It was right in the heart of North London's sort of trendy community. There were loads of people who had £5 that they'd put on the table for something new and enjoyable like this. You know, and then it was really just a question of getting the act. And that basically involved going to watch other little shows. Other people were beginning to do a similar thing at the same time. Identifying the acts whom you liked, going up to them afterwards and saying, would you like to come, and if you come and play at my club, I'll give you £20. And them saying, invariably, yes, taking their phone number, phoning them up 2 days later and confirming the arrangement, they would turn up half an hour before the show. The format was invariably four acts at that time, you know, two in the first half, interval, two in the second half, all performing for 20 minutes each. You give them each, say, £20 each at the end of the night, and any money that was left over from the door sales was your own. And not really rocket science. And it always amazes me, still does, when I go to gigs this time, not as a promoter but as an employed comedian, and people get it so wrong. You know, they'll do it in a big cavernous room, or they'll do it in the middle, they'll put open their gig in the middle of nowhere, or they'll do it the one I can never get my head round is when the seats aren't facing the stage. You think, who would put on any kind of entertainment? But you go to these clubs where they've got these kind of, you know, German beer keller type trestle tables, you know, kind of parallel to the stage, which means inevitably 50% of your audience isn't have their back to the performer. I mean, I'm not a fool, but I'm not a genius. I could work out, hey, you've got to have someone up there, they're going to be talking to you. We really would be helpful if you turn around and you were facing them. You know.
My favourite is when they've got that and then they're eating as well.
But yeah, I mean,
killer.
Yeah, how do you laugh when you've got your mouth is full of food? I mean, you know, ludicrous stuff. There's all kinds of other, you know, things that you learn on the way. But the basic things are, you know, lights, sound, audience facing the right way. If you do that, you're halfway there. Yeah. But anyway, I just said I had a talent for doing this, and over the years that followed, I opened two or three clubs, not necessarily all at the same time, and I developed a reputation for being someone who was a good club organiser. And I think that was a justified reputation. I think I did a good job, and I made a little bit of money as well. I developed all my contacts in the world of comedy, which was now kind of turning into, if not an industry, certainly a small business. And, you know. And
what was your criteria for choosing comics to go to your club? Was it always just the ones that made the audience laugh, or did you have another one?
Well, you have to remember that at that time there was an artistic criteria that was brought to bear on what people did that at times transcended simply their ability to make the audience laugh. You would book acts who would take risks either in what they had to say on stage or through their their mode of performance. So you were, it was not considered a bad thing to book an act that nobody liked. There was a kind of a different ethos that, well, this guy's he's trying something different, or something experimental, he's taking a bit of a risk, and so on and so on. If someone didn't get many laughs, no one really thought, they would never come up to you as you might, they would do now. You come up and say, oh, what would you book that person for? They would take a dial. I mean, embarrassing, people would never say that. They'd say, yeah, oh, that was a bit different.
That was interesting.
That was interesting. And, well, that is a value that I have. I have tried to hold on to as much as I can. Interesting, like, there was a my own club, Hampstead, this is now 25 years later. We had this act on, who I'd seen in Edinburgh, called Dr. Brown. And he does this act. I haven't got the vocabulary to capably describe it, except to say it's very different. And it's one of those acts that can easily fail. But I thought, no, this guy's got something. It's different. And I booked him. And he did get an encore. All right. And I felt so pleased for him and for myself that I'd stuck to my guts. You'd never see him at the Comedy Store in John Cruise or something, you know, where it's all about play safe, gags who are going to, you know, are going to get the laughs. Yeah, it's all kind of, everything's geared now towards safety. And I'll be honest, I've been affected by that myself, you know, but I do try and back those acts who take a risk. If I believe that they have an underlying funniness. I won't do it just because they're different or they try and shock or they've got a gimmick or an angle. That won't, you know, I can spot the difference. But there are some acts out there who I know are funny, but I also know there's a chance they may not connect with the audience on the night, and I'll back those acts. And not many, and it's worth saying my club, although it's not a particularly big one, it has a good reputation. It's been going 17 years. It's part of the, you know, the London comedy club scene, Hampstead Comedy Club. It's a well-known, you know, yeah, I don't mind saying it's quite a respected club. But most clubs of that ilk play very, very safe, even the smaller ones. But I think I still walk, you know.
Also, one of the things I was going to bring up,
yeah,
it sounds a bit jaded, but yeah, a lot of promoters, I think, identify comedy as gags. If it's a gag, then it's comedy, and if it's not a gag, which means that people like Billy Connolly, Eddie Izzard, would never have got in through that scene because they don't do gags as such. They tell funny stories, or they build characters, or they create a world.
Well, I think the answer to that is, what you have to realise is most comedy promoters wouldn't know funny if it stood up and stabbed them in the eye. All they know is, are people coming through the door? You know, they have their personal favourites and stuff like that. Are people coming through? Are they going down well every time? Are they good for my club? That's what most comedy promoters do. And they can't see much beyond that. I'm not sure that I agree with you that they only want gag merchants.
I'm saying that it's a prevalence amongst a lot of promoters. I wouldn't say it's universal.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And that is why I and many other comedians like myself, we've taken refuge, if you like, away from the circuit, which is about the gag count, getting the audience laughing, keeping them happy, keeping them drinking so the landlord makes a few quid, and it's general kind of an upbeat night. If you want to do comedy which is a little bit more experimental, challenging, diverse, you choose the word, then you're much better off doing what I have done and many others like me, who were never really comfortable on the circuit with the kind of comedy they wanted to do, of going into the world of doing the one-man show, where the audience have come to see you, the contract is with you, rather than with the whole evening, where inevitably, if you're one, you know, if you're one of three or four acts, it's not the audience's fault. You're bound to start making judgments about which one you prefer. I like that one. I didn't like the second one. I didn't like either. He was boring, or he was too Jewish. Too many stories. Too many this. Too many that. As opposed to the one who came after me, where it was belly laughs all the way through. And that, you know, I don't blame the audience for that, but it's the way, it's the environment which you find yourself in. But if you do a one-man show, you'll judge purely on your own terms. And that's the attraction of it to me and to many other comics who kind of, dare I say, think about what they're doing in their job.
It's one of the things that I find very difficult for people, because I didn't go to the early comedy gigs, but people always talk about that electricity in the atmosphere, and it's that not knowing whether the comic's going to fail, that fear that spreads the room, and the audience is so relieved when it actually works, and that whole thing, which I haven't experienced in many clubs for a long time.
Well, that is true, but it wasn't always a negative thing that they might fear that a failure, but the possibility that they might come up with a bit of magic. Yeah, and I don't. And I'm not. I promise, I'm not sentimentalising. It was like that. I mean, it was something quite unique. That something really new was happening here. It was exciting. It was unpredictable, and you could see little bits of magic happen before your eyes. But of course, you know, when people have a business, it doesn't matter whether it's, you know, selling walnuts or selling comedians, they want to hang on to that business, they want it to grow. And when you do that, it's very difficult not to play safe and make sure that the product is not only good, but is consistently good, which leads to a kind of a whole commodification of what you're selling, of the commodification of the comedian. Here is someone who will come on, and for 20 minutes, half an hour, he will be in control of the room, he will have plenty of laughs, he will not offend you, and he will lead the stage to general approval and applause. And all comedians have to now fit that template, which, in a way, I mean, the upside of that is, it's still a great cheap night out, a decent, I mean, I'm using my club as an example, not because I'm trying to promote it. You know, if you come to my club, the chances are, for under 10 quid, you're going to have a good night out.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to have a good laugh. You might see one or two quite exceptional comedians. You can have a beer with it. It won't go on forever. You know, it'll be down at 11 o'clock. If you want to go on afterwards, or just go home and do the babysitter, whatever you want to do. It's okay. It's a very, hassle-free night. Well, that's another, sorry, just rewind. That's another mistake that people went open comedy clubs who, the shows, they go on so bleeding long, they go on for 2 hours, 3 hours, three intervals, and by the time you get to the end, the audience have had enough, they've had a sleep, they want to go to sleep, they want to go home. You know, the whole idea of that more is better is completely counter to the best comedy. Generally, most people, an hour and a half is enough, 2 hours, absolute maximum. And these are things I'm spouting all these wisdoms because I've made all the mistakes, not because I have some talent for it. We always used to have two intervals, always. And then one night, I can't remember why, there was something, they were short of bar staff or whatever, we had to say, look, we can only have one interval tonight. Oh, I only have one interval. The show was immediately 30% better. Because the audience were kind of focused, right? You stop, have a break, everyone goes and gets a drink, goes to the toilet, has a chat, goes out, fresh air, cigarette, fine, back, see the rest of the show. But these places where it goes, oh, you have to get up, sit down, whatever, wait, and a compere comes on again and does another 10 minutes to get you back. You feel, by the end of it, you feel rotten. You know. It's just, no, it's not, you know what I mean?
Completely ground down by it all, yeah.
Well, yeah, worn out. Mm. And so, the poor sod who goes on at the end, he's really got his work cut out.
The so-called headliner, yeah. Yeah, really tough. What's, So you went to the comedy store and you just were electrified by it. And you started really quickly.
Yeah, I was. Instantly, I would say, I was. Along with a lot of other people. Yeah. I mean, it was just something like, Jesus Christ, this is amazing, isn't it? Yeah, what's going on here? Yeah. The only difference from me and most of the other people in the world is that I thought, I'm going to get involved. Mm. Initially, though, only on the organisational side, I kind of knew, although I think I am quite a funny person, I knew that if I had a go, I knew, as I sat there and watched, if I had a go, I'd find it hard. So I sat on that ambition to perform until I thought I was ready to dip my toe. And then I did, as I said, I did perform, and in a way my fears were right. When it came to club comedy, I just wasn't much good at it. Although I subsequently discovered later on in my career, such as it exists, that it's not just that I didn't have the talent for it. I didn't really want it. I didn't really want to be a club comic. I mean, I didn't realise that at the time, but I now realise that, I wanted to do something that was a little bit more ambitious than get up in front of lots of slightly inebriated people who are just out for a good time and please them. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but it wasn't for me. I wanted to write shows that might fail, but where might fail as much as they might succeed, but that had a different kind of impact on the people who came.
When you opened your first club, you weren't emceeing?
You just were the day, right. In those days.
So you just got up and said, hello.
Yeah, my name's Ivor, here's someone called, what's his name, you'd read his name off a bit of paper, Ben Elton, Clive Anderson, John Hegley, a man, he does some impressions, his name's Rory Bremner. Yeah, he didn't even know who these people were. They'd roll on and they'd be amazing. You know, where'd they come from? You know? And then you give them £20 at the end and they go, thank you. You know, and then they'd say, can we do this again? Yeah, sure. And no time at all, people were queuing around the block.
And how long did it take you to go from that point to actually starting to write jokes?
I think it was a few years. It was 3 or 4 years before I had what was then the courage, because I was in a doubly difficult position. One, most people think, God, am I going to do this? Am I going to go up there and try and make people laugh? That's bad enough. There was an additional level of difficulty for me because I'd established myself as a promoter. So it's a bit like the guy who owns the art gallery deciding to have his own exhibition. You know, we'll forget Picasso, forget Rembrandt. We're going to see Ivor's paintings now. So I was really... that was the bigger risk for me, that the comics, with whom up till then I had a very good relationship, would thinking, who does he think he is? Why doesn't he just stick to taking the money and all that? So in that sense, from that, and I don't care who knows it, I am quite proud of myself for taking what was then a very brave step. And there are comedians who are out there now who still regard me as someone who should have stuck to what he did. Comedians, generalisation coming up, are incredibly conservative people. They're the most tight-arsed, mean, ungenerous, boring, dull, evil-minded, ugly-natured, unpleasant group of people you could wish to meet. And I'm proud now to be one.
Guess they've done that far more. top one.